Cold crash at Roswell, widely thought to be the best documented proof of alien existence and visiting of this earth. So we'll be speaking with him. I think you'll find it fascinating. However, first, we're going to go to Linda Howe in Philadelphia and get her weekly update. However, even before that, we're going to welcome a couple of new stations to the network as we continue to grow, carrying Greenland, WGNS AM radio in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And that's also Nashville, Murfreesboro and Nashville, Tennessee. And also KOFE AM in St. Marie's, Idaho. KOFE AM in St. Marie's, Idaho. Welcome. Good to have you both on board, and I hope you'll be contributing this evening and making some calls. This program, for the weeks we've been on the air, you'll be, I'm sure, happy to know, now is carried by 75 affiliates nationwide as we continue to grow at an outstanding pace. So, now, to all the way back to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and with her weekly report, here is author, investigator, Linda Howe. Linda, good evening.
Hi, Art.
Hi.
Well, reports about several phenomena have crossed my desk this week. One is a news story from Waurika, Oklahoma, about a rancher there who discovered that 1,700 of his cattle disappeared between August 3rd and August 7th.
Did you say 1,700?
1,700.
Wow.
The Jefferson County, Oklahoma Sheriff's Office has put a search out for 850 cows and 850 calves. The first theory was cattle rustling, but Sheriff Don Allen said it would take 25 trucks to haul away that many animals, and that would be obvious to residents in the small farm community of Waurika. I will keep following up on this mystery. The rancher so far does not want to talk, and perhaps understandably, because apparently even the bank that holds the note on the animals have gone out and confirmed that the animals are missing. Everyone is puzzled, and of course this poor rancher is facing a major financial crisis.
Sure, I'm curious, Linda, of those that you do interview or request interviews with that have had something like this happen, how many generally say, no, I don't want to talk to you, go away?
It can be, in some cases, if I thought over the last 14 years, maybe 50-50. As many as 50% of the people that I talk to in interviews say they don't want to do anything publicly.
Wow. So then we're missing, no doubt, a lot of very good stories.
Yeah, the challenge is to get to the facts and to encourage people to come forth to discuss some of these phenomena, because that may help us all to understand. And I'm beginning to feel from the letters I'm getting from the Dreamland audience that more and more people are beginning to communicate that I think are really very, very credible and solid cases. And in this case, too, animal disappearances have been reported in other regions of the United States and Canada, even England, over the past couple of decades. Earlier this year, in 1994, 200 dogs were reported missing from backyards in northern Georgia, and several hundred cats have disappeared from Falls Church, Virginia, Plano, Texas, parts of California, and Canada just in the past few years. And the intriguing question is, could any of these animals have been lifted up in beams of light, as reported in some of the animal mutilation and UFO abduction cases? I don't know how we would prove it, but the question remains, since there have been eyewitnesses to seeing animals lifted up in beams of light.
Sure.
Now, since last weekend's Dreamland, when I interviewed investigator Gail Stalen about two more mutilations in Angel Fire, New Mexico, east of Taos, there were three more odd animal deaths in northern New Mexico. Last Friday, rancher Max Cordova near Espanola discovered two of his 10-year-old cows dead with tongues cut out deep in the throat, udders removed in clean, bloodless circles in the rectum's cord out. That makes seven such similar cattle mutilations in the Taos, New Mexico area just since May. And in three of those, pathologist Dr. John Altshuler found evidence of high heat at the excision lines, hot enough to cook the hemoglobin.
Boy.
Mr. Cordova also found another cow last Saturday lying in a pasture, shaking from head to hoof, as he put it, and then it died, cause unknown. I contacted a veterinarian who did a necropsy on that animal and collected tissues from the mutilated cows for pathology examination, and I'll report those results when we have them.
Good.
Reports from England are that the last big formation in Wiltshire near Avebury was a huge spider web laid out in a wheat field. And other images this summer have included scorpions, a beetle, a large eye, galaxy-like formations, and something that people have described as an infinity symbol. English newspapers and television have covered the mysterious formations with less ridicule and less emphasis on the hoax theory this year, and yet in the United States there has been no coverage about the continuing formations at all. And in the next month or so, I hope to report from Dr. Levengood, who has been getting plants from England, to see again if we are finding that same pattern of biochemical and biophysical changes which cannot be hoaxed.
Why do you think something that is a story and making headlines there in this area wouldn't be touched by the media here?
Because that 1991 tabloid story about Doug and Dave being the answer to the crop circle mystery that was carried by all of our networks and CNN and Time and Newsweek and the New York Times and all of that accepted that those two old men were responsible for the mystery, when it was very clear that since the phenomenon was worldwide, had been reported in up to 20-some countries in the year 1990, and going into 1991, those two men were not responsible for the entire phenomenon, but the media bought that story, and once the media, quote, mainstream media, has bought the hoax theory, then they don't go back to cover it.
Well, isn't it worth asking, Linda, why we have these serious questions, formations, cattle mutilations, all the rest of it, that absolutely cannot be explained, and the media deals with those stories, and then along comes one hoax story, they buy it hook, line, and sinker.
Right, and it's like one of the ranchers in Alabama last year that I interviewed for my new documentary said to me, it's denial, Linda. Denial is a coping mechanism for people.
It's
much easier to deny it than it is to face the fact that some very strange kind of intelligence is interacting with our planet.
I guess maybe that does explain it, Linda.
And going from the standpoint that we are dealing with hard physical evidence in the crop circles and the animal mutilations and even in the human abduction syndrome, there's also the hard physical science area that was involved with the impact on Jupiter. And last week in Europe, a group of astronomers, physicists, and other scientists met in Holland to discuss the latest updates about the comet collision.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lead investigators, Dr. Heidi Hamel, she's an astronomer at MIT who specializes in high-speed satellite imaging and spectroscopy, and in fact, she was the one who was getting all those first images, and she's the one who took happily that big bottle of champagne right into the first television news conference to present it to Dr. Eugene Shoemaker and his wife and others, when they had the very first image of that big black circle at the bottom of Jupiter. And I talked with her Friday about what scientists have been learning so far in the wake of the spectacular explosions from the comet impact, because even in that there have been some mysteries that are yet not solved. And just a moment, I will hook up here and we will hear Dr. Hamel.
All right. She may be the one that for a while we called Heidi.
We've had some tantalizing hints of interesting things on Jupiter. Some of the way that the material is spreading, particularly in ultraviolet wavelengths, is very interesting. We're seeing spreading in latitude, things migrating across the normal lines of latitude. You know, when you look at Jupiter, you see these bands.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, normally the winds blow along the bands. So that's what we think of as the winds. But when we take some of this high altitude material, it looks like it's just drifting across the bands.
And that would suggest what? No atmospheric motion at the upper?
Well, it suggests different atmospheric motion at those upper levels. It's not blowing, the winds aren't blowing the same way high up as they are deep down. And we didn't really have any way to measure that before, and now we're starting to think that we can actually see that motion happening, which is one of the things that we were all very excited about beforehand. We thought, you know, we might be able to do this, and now we're starting to actually believe we really can.
And how long do you think, at this point, are these brighter spots on the surface of Jupiter going to last? Will it be a permanent one?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't think I can really answer that in any detail. We know that features are still there now. We just had some new data from the Hubble telescope come down yesterday, and you can very clearly see them, and we can see them in ground-based images too. You don't need the Hubble to see them. So we know that this stuff is still hanging around there now, a month, more than a month afterwards. As to whether or not it's going to be permanent, we really don't know. We won't know that for a while. Maybe, you know, next year, if we see these things are fading rapidly, we'll be able to say, yeah, they're going to go away. It's pretty clear they're not forming a new red spot.
Mm-hmm.
Some people thought, oh, this is how the Great Red Spot was formed. But that doesn't seem to be true. We're not seeing giant new vortices or hurricanes forming at these latitudes. We're really seeing a band of material. So it's just a question of how long it takes that band to fade. It might take a year, might take two.
Mm-hmm. And somebody with like a normal telescope, let's say a 4-inch dynoscope reflector or something like that, can they still see these impact places clearly?
Someone with a small telescope who knows what to look for can probably still see them. It's a little bit harder than it was a month ago, though, and here's why. A month ago, these features were very localized. They were spots, and it's easy to see a dark spot. But when you then take that spot and you spread it out as it's happening, its contrast drops quite a bit. And so if you don't know where to look, it's not as easy to see the spots. So it's a question of how familiar a person is with Jupiter. If they know where Jupiter normally does not have dark band here, and they see the band, then they know that's from the impact site. But it doesn't have these very obvious big dark splotches like it did a month ago.
Mm-hmm. So the most outstanding remaining mystery is, why was the substance black where these impacts were?
Yep, that's of one of the questions. Another question that we're all still very curious about is, how deep did these pieces really penetrate before they exploded?
Right.
Well, that's something that was very interesting, because that tells us a lot about the comet, it tells us a lot about Jupiter, and we really don't know the answer to that yet. We think it didn't penetrate down to the water cloud layer, because we didn't see any Jovian water,
mm-hmm.
just like we saw no comet water.
Mm-hmm.
At the meeting in Holland, we were talking about the fact that we did not see the bright flashes as these pieces went in,
mm-hmm.
the meteor phase. Most of what we saw was the fireballs blowing out after the pieces had exploded.
Right.
And the fact that we didn't see them on the way in suggests to many of us that they went relatively deep, below the ammonia cloud decks, which is really the top cloud layer that we see at visible wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not sure about that.
And if it did go deep, then it would again be the question, why not see water?
Yeah, that's right.
So are the mysteries about Jupiter are still not all resolved, and at the end of September there will be another major scientific meeting in Baltimore. There might be more to report then.
All right. Well, it would be interesting to know, A, how deep they really did go, and B, Richard Hoagland, who's been on the program, has speculated a number of times that the black spots were carbon, and they seem disinclined to be very interested in talking about the black spots. Have you noticed?
Well, he said that they have found some odd elements, like lithium, and some other really odd ones, which they're going to have more papers presented in September. But in terms of the identity of the black material, at least according to Heidi, so far, they do not know what it is.
All right. Well, Linda, gee, a wonderful report, and I was hoping to get some follow-up, and I hope there'll be more on the collisions. I've been fascinated by that.
Right. I plan to talk with her and Dr. Shoemaker again after the September meeting in Baltimore.
All right. Wonderful. Linda Howe, as always. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Let's give out your address. I know a lot of people want to communicate to you, so give it out.
Yes, I have been very grateful for the increasing number of letters, extraordinary stories from people, and I will continue to try to share some of these in future Dreamlands as we go with those who give me permission. You can write to Linda Howe at Post Office Box 538, in Huntingdon Valley, Pennsylvania, spelled H-U-N-T-I-N-G, D as in dog, O-N, Huntingdon Valley, Pennsylvania, and the zip code is 19006.
All right, there you've got it, and we'll give that out again in the program. Linda, as thank always, thank you.
Thank you, Art.
Right, Linda Howe, our reporter slash investigator, in Philadelphia and frequently elsewhere. She travels around the world to look at this sort of phenomenon. And we will continue to have her on the program. All right, Dreamland continues in a moment with something a lot of people have been waiting for. So, crash at Roswell. We're going to reach out to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, I hope, and find Kevin Randall. Hi, Kevin, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. We've only got a couple of minutes before the bottom of the hour break, Kevin, so tell us something quickly about yourself.
I think the important thing to know is I used to be an Army helicopter pilot. I spent 12 years as an Air Force intelligence officer, and I've been investigating UFOs for about 20 years. So I've got a background that in aviation and investigative work of one nature, and I could bring all that to bear on the investigation that Don Schmidt and I conducted to learn what exactly happened at Roswell in July of 1947.
Well, we'll certainly get to that, but if you were in intelligence work and you piloted helicopters, I've really got to ask you about something up front here that has been a big matter of contention with our audience. What are these black helicopters that are flying around? Any idea, Kevin?
I actually have no ideas at all. The stories seem to make no logical sense whatsoever. According to FAA regulations and all other regulations, if you have an aircraft, it has got to have a number on it and it's got to be flown in accordance with FAA regulations, and these things seem to violate all those regulations. I don't know what's going on.
Do you get reports of them? In other words, I'm sure very much like we do here, you are in a circle of people that hears about this kind of stuff. And so do you also get reports of these black helicopters?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. People from all over. In fact, up in Portland, Oregon, I was working with John Kirby and Don Newman up there. And the first time we ever met with them, they told us a number of stories about black helicopters, and I confess they just make no sense to me at all.
Well, all right. I don't know what to do about that or say about that. It's just kind of an ongoing thing, and a lot of people are, to use the street term, kind of freak out about it, Kevin. And they,
oh, absolutely.
They feel these things are somehow flying around up there with... even though we don't have reports of harm coming to anybody, somehow people feel they're trying to do harm to them. All right, Kevin, stand by. We'll take a break here at the bottom of the hour. It'll be about 4 minutes, and we'll come back and find out if we can really get the truth about the UFO crash at Roswell, which, again, is considered to be the incident here on Earth with perhaps the best documentation to prove that they really have or are here, have been here, or are here. We'll be back. O2 FM.
This is a pre-recorded, previously broadcast program.
Go ahead. I told you it's Houston. Say again, Seven.
This is Dreamland at 35 minutes into the flight, and once again, here is our guest, Kevin Randall, author of The Truth About the Crash, the UFO Crash at Roswell. Kevin?
Yes.
Good. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
All right, Kevin. Just before we get started with regard to your story, recently Showtime had the movie on Roswell, which I saw. And I don't want to lead you into any review you don't want to give, but I sure would like to find out from you what you think about that movie.
Well, it was based on the first book that Don Schmidt and I did, The UFO Crash at Roswell. So frankly, we liked it.
You liked it?
Yes. we were prejudiced. In fact, both of us are in the film in cameo roles. Don plays a bartender, and in there's a scene in the sheriff's office where there's a newsman way in the back, arguing with the deputy, and as they move in and out of the camera, you can see me back there arguing with the deputy.
Oh, no kidding. That was you, huh?
Yes, that was me.
Yes, I do recall. I certainly do recall. Is there anything about the film that you found distressing or inaccurate or blown up, you know, for the sake of cinematography?
They did a very good job of trying to stick pretty much to the story. And, you know, as the director said a number of times, they were making a film. So you have to keep it in context of them making a film. When I first saw the script, I was a little bit bothered by the stuff from Dreamland, Area 51, the animal mutilations, the human abductions. I thought this really has no relevance to the Roswell case. But in the context of the film, with Martin Sheen saying, telling Jesse Marcel in the context of the film, well, then none of it's true. Well, maybe some of it's true. And in the context of the disinformation put out by the government, I thought it worked very well.
What about one thing that struck me in the film was the size of the debris field at Roswell. My gosh, for as far as the eye could see almost, you know, there was debris. Was there that much debris at the original crash site?
On the debris field, according to Jesse Marcel, the debris field continued for 3/4 of a mile.
Wow.
It was 200 to 300 feet wide stretched for 3/4 of a mile. And in fact, the reason the debris field is so large is because I said something to the director. So the next day I found myself walking way out into the desert, dropping debris here and there with a number of other people. And Paul David, the executive producer, suggested, well, maybe the director was getting even with you for shooting your mouth off. You shouldn't have told him the debris field wasn't large enough. So.
Yes. All right. Let's back up a little bit and have you tell the story of the truth about what occurred at Roswell, as best you've been able to determine it. And how did you determine what the truth was, by the way? Series of interviews, no doubt.
Interviews with the eyewitnesses, people who were there. No longer are we relegated to having to deal with this on the basis of my father saw this and told me about it, my husband saw this and told me about it. We're now to the point where this is what I saw. So we have the first-hand witnesses, all of whom are named, or the majority of whom are named in the book.
How many witnesses of that caliber were you able to find?
We have found about a dozen people now who were on the debris field, on the impact site where the craft and the bodies were found, who have talked to us about some aspect of it. Mm. Unfortunately, a number of them have since passed away, since we had an opportunity to talk to them, but we do have that many. In fact, Don Ecker at UFO Magazine in California just found another first-hand witness who corroborated some of the things that we published in the book. So no longer can people point to us and say, well, the way you ask questions, your agenda had you lead these people into what you wanted to say. Now there's a witness that we had no contact with when he first told the story, who was found by someone else, and now that we've been able to review what he said, he tended to corroborate what the other first-hand witnesses had said as well.
Have you spent any introspective time, Kevin, asking yourself that question, did I lead people into this? Did I put ideas in their head, or was I objective?
That always runs through your mind, especially when you begin to get to the story as you wanted to hear it. I mean, we wanted to find the first-hand witnesses, people to see the craft, the bodies. And when we began to find those people, the question was, are they telling us what we want to hear?
That's right.
Or are they telling us what they actually observed? And how can we corroborate this? And what it turns out is we kept a lot of the information to ourselves before the publication of the book for that very reason. One of the first-hand witnesses we identified was Steve McKinsey in the book, because he asked us not to use his real name because he valued his privacy.
Mm-hmm.
But he led us down a number of roads that we had not gone before. The crash site being, the impact site being much closer to Roswell, not the debris field found by Mac Brazel, but the impact site. The shape of the craft not being a classic flying saucer with a dome on it, but something more heel-shaped. The number of bodies, what they look like. He told us all this stuff, and it varied from the conventional wisdom. And we thought, well, this is wonderful, this is what we want, but is this guy feeding us a line?
Sure.
But we found corroborative testimony. Lewis Rickett, the NCOIC of the Counterintelligence Office at Roswell, corroborated the shape of the craft using the same words almost, that it was heel-shaped, that the drive they made from Roswell, he and a man that he identified as Sheridan Cabot, made from the base at Roswell was about 45 minutes to the impact site, not the 2.5 to 3 hours it takes to get out to the debris field. So it's much closer to Roswell.
Well, let me understand. The impact site versus the debris field, how much distance between the two?
About 40 miles.
40 miles?
Based on what we've been able to determine, 35 to 40 miles.
All right, well then that means the craft broke up in the air.
The problem we have with that is that it looked like an intact craft was found on the impact site. We have a debris field, and the debris, the wide range of debris, you don't have the wide range of debris you'd have if the thing broke up in the air. You have some metallic debris, you have some wires, things like that. But if an airplane broke up in the air, you'd have a lot of other stuff. And you don't have that on the debris field.
Well, yeah, but that was a gigantic debris field, and how much of that kind of stuff could any craft lose and still be basically intact to impact anywhere else?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and we simply don't have the answer to that question. What we know is we have a debris field, and that was described by a number of people. Mac Brazel telling his son talking about that. We have General Exxon, for example, told us about two distinct sites, the one closer to Roswell, the debris field.
Yes.
We have a number of witnesses leading us, telling us those things. There are questions we don't have the answers to because we haven't got to the internal workings of this thing.
All right, the creatures that they showed in the movie, did they arrive at how to make those creatures look in the movie?
I believe what they did in the movie was they took some of the testimony that came about in our from our first book, some of the things we'd said in the work that we were putting together for the second book, The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, especially based on the eyewitness testimony we'd since uncovered, took some of their cues from the abduction phenomenon in the current state of UFO literature,
uh-huh,
and created a being that sort of fit all the descriptions. But the beings found at Roswell, according to the eyewitnesses that we talked to, were much more human-looking than they were alien-looking. They're not the typical grays. The eyes, although larger than human eyes, still had pupils. The heads, although slightly larger than human heads, were just slightly larger than they would be proportioned for the bodies. The bodies were extremely thin. The bones were very fragile, according to that. So some of the things that we had learned from our investigation were incorporated in it, but they also wanted to make the creatures look alien, more alien than it is.
Then they probably were. All right, fine. Well, even so, Kevin, assuming that there were beings and they were recovered, we would not do autopsies and then cremate the remains. We would obviously retain for all time, through some method or another, these bodies. So someplace, now, today, those bodies must exist.
Yes. The best information we have, and again, this is very speculative based on just a couple of people, is that they are in Nevada. Not at Dreamland, not at Groom Lake or Area 51, but at a special location in the central areas of Nevada in the mountains.
Really?
As you know, what, 90% of the state of Nevada is government territory.
Oh, we well know that.
Yeah, and our understanding is that there was a special facility created in central Nevada in the mountains for the preservation of the bodies and a great deal of the debris recovered at Roswell.
Gee, I feel honored. In the same state with the bodies, huh? would that be some? I'm always looking for some way, Kevin, rather than reviewing what occurred all those years ago, fascinating as that is, to approach it today and try and prove it today. I mean, everybody wants to do that. That would be one way.
That certainly would be one way. I think one of the other things we need to do is, and I think Don Schmidt and I have done a fairly good job, and to give credit where credit was due, I think that Stanton Friedman, I think that Bill Moore have pretty well explored what happened at Roswell back in 1947. What we need to do now is find out what happened at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in 1947.
That's
some
right.
of that work has been done, but there's a great deal more to be done, and learn what was going on in the UFO phenomenon from that point forward, and that may provide us the clues to get to where we want to go today. But we need to take the investigation out of New Mexico and move it into Ohio and other locations.
Well, as there were witnesses with regard to what occurred in New Mexico, you would think there would also be witnesses, although probably more carefully warned, from Ohio that you could interview and kind of track what's happened to these bodies and what happened in Ohio.
And that's right. Again, General Exon told us that he was at the base when this happened, July of 1947. Later, he became the base commander at Wright-Patterson in the mid-1960s. But he told us that one of the bodies had been taken to Denver because the Army's mortuary service was housed at Lowry Army Airfield at the time.
Yes.
And that it was experimented on there, obviously with an eye for the best way to preserve it without... chemically altering the tissue samples or the blood the way we normally do when you embalm a body. They would want to preserve it as pristine as they possibly could without allowing it to decay. We have been told that one of the bodies went to MacDill, I think, Air Force Base in Florida and it had been preserved there. But you're absolutely correct. We have some witnesses at Wright Field and later Wright-Patterson Air Force Base who provided us with some clues. General Exxon told us some things that when he first told us them weren't that interesting. He mentioned that there would be groups of men coming in from Washington, D.C. to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. He was responsible for getting them an airplane, and then they would go out and investigate a UFO sighting and would come back to Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. We thought, well, that's curious, but not overly significant. Now with the discovery of the 4602nd, at that point it would have been the 1127th Air Activities Group, and Project Moondust, that information becomes extremely important because it's clear that the people Exxon was talking about were working with the 1127th Air Activities Group.
So nobody knew that group was at Wright-Patt?
The group was not at Wright-Patt. They were at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, in the Washington, D.C. area. They came into Wright-Patterson. He provided them with a Wright-Patterson Air Force airplane. He said they would come in civilian clothes on commercial airliners and then go out and investigate the UFOs. So if you had a smart aleck reporter who tried to trace these guys back, he could trace them back to Wright-Patterson, home of Project Blue Book, and everybody's happy.
And that's where it would stop. All right, hold on just a moment, Kevin Randall. We'll be right back to you.
Yes.
All right, let us do a little of the original stuff and tell everybody, because there may be some out there who don't know. Back in 1947, what were the sequence of events, roughly? What happened?
What we believe happened, based, again, on eyewitness testimony, on the evening of July 4th, 1947, between 11:17 and 11:27 p.m., an object crashed just north of Roswell, New Mexico. Next day, the military is out there. They've cordoned the area and are picking up the craft and the bodies. Major Edwin Easley, the Provost Marshal of the 509th Bomb Group, told me it was an extraterrestrial spacecraft. Steve McKenzie told me that the object was heel-shaped, that there were five bodies. Lewis Rickett told me that the object was heel-shaped and that some of the metal was extremely thin, but he couldn't bend it, they couldn't do anything to cut it. They recovered the craft, they recovered the bodies, took them to the Roswell Army Airfield. On the evening of July 5th, morning of July 6th, two airplanes left Roswell carrying the bodies. One went to Andrews Army Airfield, Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, D.C., so top-level people in the government could see the bodies. The other one went to Wright-Patterson, Wright Field at the time. They didn't put all the bodies on one airplane in case one of them crashed. On Sunday, July 6th, now we run back into the conventional wisdom. Mac Brazel finds the field of metallic debris on the morning of the 5th. On the morning of the 6th, he takes it into Roswell, takes some of the debris into Roswell, shows it to the Chavez County Sheriff George Wilcox, who in turn calls the 509th Bomb Group, and Jesse Marcel, and apparently Sharon and W. Cabot, who was the commander of the counterintelligence office, was sent out to the debris field. They spent the day of the 7th out there, collected some of the debris, came back late at night. Marcel showed it to his wife and son, and then went on out to the base. On July 8th, the Army announces, we captured a flying saucer on a ranch in the Roswell region. By 4 or 5 o'clock that afternoon, General Ramey at 8th Air Force Headquarters said, no, they made a mistake. It was merely a weather balloon.
Who made that announcement? How high did that go?
The
original announcement that a UFO crashed.
It went all the way to the president. I mean, the president knew.
The president knew.
There's no question. Edwin Easley, the provost marshal, told me one of the reasons he didn't like talking about this was because he promised the president he wouldn't talk about it. Now, I don't know whether Easley told the president personally, told Truman personally he wouldn't talk about it, or Truman's representative in New Mexico, but it's in essence the same thing. Easley felt that he had promised the president he would not talk about it.
Wow.
I had at one time, in my discussions with Easley, I told him that I knew General Thomas DuBose. And I said, do you know General DuBose? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I had General DuBose call you and say it was okay to talk. Would you feel more comfortable then?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no. I didn't realize that what I needed to get was the president to call this guy and tell him it was okay to talk about it. I couldn't find a general officer high-ranking enough.
All right. What about the other end of the scale? In the movie Roswell, it showed literally platoon after platoon of regular grunt-type GIs out there picking up debris like so many cigarette butts that you got to pick up around, that I remember picking up around the barracks. And they were doing that, crawling on their hands and knees, and there was a ton of debris. Shouldn't there be a lot of low-ranking people who participated in that debris pickup that you could find and interview?
Absolutely. And we've talked to many of them. We've probably talked to 4 dozen people who handled the metallic debris.
Wow.
That didn't see the craft, did not see the bodies, but handled metallic debris. So, yes, there were a great number of them.
Okay, well, that's important. What did they say about the nature of the debris?
Robert Smith, for example, who was a sergeant, helped load some of the debris on airplanes, said that he'd seen a foil sample of it, that when you wadded it up into a ball and dropped it on the table, it would unfold itself.
Yes, they showed that on the movie.
And that's a very easy one to show because, it's something that's so unusual that sticks in the mind. An awful lot of people talked about that one. Bill Brazel, the son of the man who found it, Mac Brazel, played by Dwight Yoakam in the movie, had a piece of that foil that he talked about, and he liked it too because it would unfold itself. Frankie Rowe, whose father was a firefighter in Roswell, when a state trooper brought a piece of debris by the firehouse, saw that kind of debris. Sally Taddellini, who was a neighbor of the Brazels, saw the piece of debris that Bill Brazel brought by, and she was impressed with it because she just spent all day ironing and thought it'd be wonderful to have fabric that wouldn't wrinkle. there's a large number of people, from civilians to low-ranking military people, who saw the metallic debris and talked about what it was. When you get to the craft and the bodies, clearly that was much more important, and that was limited to a smaller number of people. But there was a large number of people who saw the metallic debris, and the description we have from some of the people is that they lined them up across that debris field, shoulder to shoulder, as you saw in the movie, picking up the metallic debris, first sweeping it at double arm intervals, then at shoulder to shoulder, then finally on their hands and knees to make sure they picked up all the debris.
Wow. In the movie, Major Marcel's had more than just one of the pieces of foil. He had a piece of debris, with some writing on it that looked like some sort of Egyptian hieroglyphics or something. It was hard to discern, but that's kind of what it looked like. Is that an accurate portrayal of what he had?
I think more accurate portrayal of what he had, according to his son, Jesse Jr., who was on the set with us, as a matter of fact.
Oh, no kidding.
After the movie Roswell, there was a short little thing they showed, and you see Jesse Jr. sitting in a chair out in the desert talking about that. Well, that was on the scene where they were filming the film.
Mm-hmm.
But according to him, the symbology was more of geometric shapes. Squares and circles and triangles and things like that. But he described it as being hieroglyphic-like. I think Mac Brazel told people that it was like Chinese writing, the Chinese symbol writing, of course.
All right, so, still just as strange. Kevin, I've got to ask you to hold on for a sec. We're
surely
at the top of the hour. We're going to do a little bit of news here at the top of the hour. And we'll be back. Radio is a wonderful land to be in. We have enough time to explore an issue the way it should be. Kevin Randall is my guest, and we're talking about the truth about the UFO crash at Roswell.